Hello, it's Adam from the Tudor Chest here. If you enjoy these podcast episodes, then perhaps you would consider becoming an official patron via my Patreon account. I release an additional weekly subscriber-only episode via Patreon, but also via Apple Podcasts, as well as bi-weekly Historian Unwrap sessions in which I speak to some of the leading historians from around the world today about their lives as historians. From as little as £5 a month, you can access all content from the Tudor Chest. Just head to patreon.com/thetudorchest or search for the podcast in Apple Podcasts. Sarah Morris is a historian, author, and also my colleague as co-director of our historic tour company, Simply Tudor Tours. She joins me today for a fascinating discussion based around the book that she wrote alongside Natalie Gruniger, In the Footsteps of Anne Boleyn. This book charts the many locations both in England and across Europe which are closely associated with Anne Boleyn, and thanks to Sarah's encyclopedic knowledge of what happened and where, she is able to recreate and reimagine spaces that no longer exist or look very different and place us in the 16th century. Whether it's the room at Windsor Castle in which Anne Boleyn was made Marquess of Pembroke, to the stunning Hotel de Cluny in Paris, to the sadly lost parts of the Tower of London and Hampton Court Palace, Sarah knows it all and can help us imagine what Anne Boleyn would have once seen, but is now sadly no longer there. Welcome back to the Tudor Chest Podcast, episode 31, In the Footsteps of Anne Boleyn, with Dr. Sarah Morris. Welcome to the Tudor Chest Podcast, Sarah Morris. How are you?
Very well, thank you, Adam. It's lovely to be speaking to you again. We're talking rather a lot recently, aren't we?
We are, all the time, basically all day, every day at the moment.
But it's all about good and exciting stuff that hopefully the people out there will be really excited to hear more about in due course.
Very much so, yes. So we're here today to talk about your book that you wrote, you co-wrote with Natalie Gruniger, In the Footsteps of Anne Boleyn. But before we get into the discussion around that, I just had a few questions just for people to get to know you a bit better, if that's okay. So a short intro into your background, where you grew up, and what you do full time.
Gosh, some questions in there. So I grew up in North Yorkshire, which is a northern county in England. And I grew up with a love of history for as long as I can remember. And I attribute that to my wonderful parents who took us out every week, just about every weekend and holiday. We'd visit historic sites, be they castles or manors or cathedrals, churches, and I fell in love with visiting historic places. And that's really how I remember a lot of my childhood. So that's kind of where I grew up and how I fell in love with history, which was only augmented at school back in my day, which was quite a few years ago now, Adam. We learned about the Tudors when you were 11 years old. This was the first year of senior school. And I remember opening a book and seeing that picture of Princess Elizabeth in her glorious red dress with her flaming red hair and auburn eyes and just being completely mesmerised by her and thinking, who is she? And then I just got completely sucked into the story. So those two strands wove together to create a deep and enduring love of English history and particularly Tudor history, which I kept to myself for a long time. I often think of myself as coming out of the closet around 2010, when quite out of the blue and quite unexpectedly, during a visit to Hever Castle, actually, my imagination took hold of me and an idea ignited about a book, a novel about Anne Boleyn, to talk about her innocence And when I got home, I started writing and I haven't stopped. So that's 13 years later. And I like most people listening to this will know once the tutors get their claws into you, it's very difficult to leave them behind. So yeah, it's been a hobby that's turned into a huge part of my life now. So coming to your question, what do I do full time? That is an interesting question. I'm a medical doctor by training, but over 20 years ago, I retrained as a coach. And in fact, I still have a coaching practice. So I work with executives and leaders, and I do cultural change programs, leadership development coaching. But increasingly, I'm making a transition away from that and reducing the size of that coaching practice and spending more and more time dedicating myself to researching and writing about Tudor history, for, of course, my website, the Tudor Travel Guide, and also for my membership, the Ultimate Guide to Exploring Tudor England, which is part of that project.
Busy lady.
Yeah, very busy, but I'm trying to temper that, because there is so much to do. I had no idea how much there was to do when you run a blog and a podcast and you create videos and you're managing social media. And honestly, it's you will know, Adam, it's a job for 10 people, really. And it's easy to get quite overwhelmed. So I'm working very hard to actually bring a lot more balance back into life and benefiting from it.
Do you have a favourite Tudor fact?
Oh God, I don't know. Favorite Tudor fact. Oh, I don't know, Adam.
Well, my one, for example, I
Go
love the
on.
fact that you probably know it already, but I love the fact that Dr. John Dee, Elizabeth the First, Doctor, part-time spy master, his code name was 007. I don't know if you knew that, but I just think that's
I did.
brilliant.
Now you've told me, I remember that. It's just incredible, isn't
It's
it?
so good. So good.
It's a bit like, I don't know whether this translates across the oceans, but of course you will know the series Blackadder by Rowan Atkinson. And I didn't know for a long time Blackadder was actually a real life person, which I thought was, it's not a Tudor fact, but I thought that was absolutely so cool.
Yeah, I found, how did I find that out? I found that out really recently. I think it was in Joanne Paul's book about the Dudley family that she mentions a Lord Blackadder a few times. So I was like, oh, it's a real thing.
It's exactly, I remember doing exactly the same. I just could not believe it. So you see, that's what happens, isn't it, to creative people. We steal facts and then we build whole stories around them. I think that's part of the fun of writing, really. Get your inspiration literally from anywhere.
Yeah, I just love, I think those sort of little Tudor tidbits are just great, aren't they? Like another one that I really enjoy is the fact that the saying sleep tight derives from the fact that Tudor beds had pulleys on them that would bring the bedding in. They would have pulleys and they would close the bedding around you. And that was the origins of the saying sleep tight, for example. Stuff like that, I think is just great because it's got to start somewhere, these sayings. And, you know, that's the origin of that saying, for example.
And I don't know whether this is Tudor, but you know, this is how our mind works, doesn't it? By association. So thank you for reminding me of that. It's probably medieval rather than Tudor, but don't let the cat out of the bag. Have you heard that one? So that's about, it's to do with, I can't remember exactly, but it's to do with weighing things and to add extra weight, you might put a cat in a bag. So it's sort of you're hiding weight. I can't remember the exact thing, but I thought it was really fun and really interesting. There are so many old sayings, aren't there, that just have their roots way, way, way back in time that have been forgotten.
Yeah, those just little bits of trivia are just brilliant. So we are here today, as I mentioned, to discuss the book that you wrote, In the Footsteps of Anne Boleyn, and you've based a lot of what you've done over the past decade also around, you know, following Anne Boleyn's footsteps. You wrote this alongside Natalie Gruninger. What inspired you to tell this particular story? Was it that moment at Hever Castle and you just thought, right, there's a story to tell here?
No, it was later than that. And I mean, the book's over 10 years old now. I think it had its 10th anniversary last year, which Natalie and I just could not believe. So the book you're talking about that I was inspired to write at Hever was the novel about Anne Boleyn, Le Temps Viendra, a novel of Anne Boleyn. But through the process of writing that, I became, I think as any good historical novelist should, become obsessed with trying to get the background as factually correct as possible. So whether you're talking about manners, etiquette, or whether you're talking about the kind of food people eat, or the places they lived, or the clothes that they wear, I went on this massive journey of discovery, learning about all this kind of the detail of Tudor life and Tudor life at the royal court. And I suppose that at this point, that particular interest fused with my long-standing love of historic buildings, and I became really obsessed and excited by researching the lost palaces, particularly because obviously Anne spent a good deal of her time there, and we cover many locations that touch on places that are no longer there, like Greenwich Palace, Richmond Palace, for example, the Privy Lodgings at Eltham, Whitehall Palace. And so I spent many, many a happy hour poring over floor plans and trying to reimagine the buildings as they would have been, and almost trying to visualize them in my mind's eye as if I was Anne moving around the building, so that when I wrote a particular scene, I could set it in an appropriate, if we didn't know exactly where it happened, an appropriate place, or if we knew where it happened, the exact place, but to try and give it as much authentic detail as possible. So I accumulated a lot of information about Tudor places along the way, and then, of course, during the course of writing, I came across Natalie's site on the Tudor Trail. We started correspondence. I told her what I was doing, and of course, on the Tudor Trail was Natalie's similar adventure into Tudor places. She started, I think, that website as a result of visiting England and then wanting to see more Tudor places, but finding it difficult to find a list of places associated with Anne. And her blog had been dedicated to try and highlight some of those. And so at some point, probably around 2012, we both realized we had a massive amount of material on Tudor places and a shared love of trying to find as many locations as possible associated with Anne Boleyn as we could, so we could go and visit them. So it was pure selfishness, Adam. We wanted to go and visit as many of these places for ourselves and go and stand in these places as possible. And we thought, you know what? Maybe there may be some other people that might be interested in that too. So we came together and joined forces, and we wrote the first of our two In the Footsteps books, which was solely dedicated to Anne Boleyn. And I think we've got about 80 locations in there that she either, basically called home or visited.
And I think that's what's so fascinating about the work you've done is that in many respects, I think more than anyone I know, your sort of encyclopedic knowledge of spaces and I remember when I remember so vividly when you and I were in Windsor Castle, and what you now see is the Georgian sort of very grand, ultra sort of glitzy Windsor Castle of the for want of a better word, modern age. You don't see the Tudor particularly, but you were able to say, oh, the room where, this room we're stood in, this is where Anne was made Marquess of Pembroke and things like that. And I think that's a story that you're able to tell that by and large, it would be quite overlooked or forgotten by a lot of people.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And that kind of thing gave us both just the most enormous thrill when we could realize things like that. And we uncovered a lot of places we'd never heard of before. And that was really thrilling as well. We also debunked a couple of places, and I think I may have mentioned this before, and I refuse to say which one. I don't want to embarrass their marketing department, but all of it was so fascinating to me, and I get equally turned on by being able to go and stand in a field where there are earthworks of a house that used to be there, as I do sometimes going into a grand, sort of manor house or palace, because I always take my imagination along with me, and that's part of the fun, is if you have a certain amount of knowledge and fact, you can recreate it. And that's what fundamentally has driven me to move on from writing these books to creating the Tudor Travel Guide, because I want people who love Tudor history to be able to, whether they're UK residents or they're coming from overseas, to be able to visit these places, and they've got all the details at their fingertips to be able to go and visit a place or stand in a space like you did at Windsor, and to know where they are and know the significance of it, and to have enough detail to be able to reimagine it. Because I know you get this really deeper felt sense of connection that I think we're all striving for. If we love history, we want to get as close to it as we can, and we know we can't get in a time machine and travel backwards, but we can use our imagination, and that's so much fun and peculiarly satisfying in a way that's quite difficult to put into words.
Yeah, that's the it's almost like the not the downside, but as historians, you're sort of we're constantly chasing ghosts in many respects. You know, it's really, really difficult to, as you say, you want to get as physically close as possible, and because time travel sadly isn't a thing, you know, places is the thing that is fills that gap for sure. So where does the story start? Where does Anne's story start? Were you able to, you know, Anne Boleyn's year of birth is a contentious subject. There's big debate. Were you able to find anything out when you were researching the book, and what goes into the books tell you what you think Anne's earliest years looks like?
Well, we certainly did research that brought that into focus. What I don't think was the aim of the book, and what we didn't do, was try and research what was her year of birth. We say in the introduction that at the time when we wrote this, certainly 1501, I think, was deemed by most historians to be the most likely time of her birth. As you say, there's still a lot of controversy about that, and it's actually been reignited right now. We won't go into that, but we weren't trying to find that out. What we were trying to do was to find the places that were associated with those early years. And I suppose what I didn't realize when I started, because I was lucky. I love France. I'm definitely a Francophile. I do parler un peu français, enough at least to enter into basic conversation and to read books. My kind of read French is better than my spoken French.
Yeah, I
And
would say the same thing.
yeah, I think it's probably true for everyone. And Natalie has a Spanish heritage in her family, so it was quite natural that I would gravitate and cover Anne Boleyn's early locations in France and the Low Countries, and that Natalie would take on Catherine of Aragon. So Natalie got to tour Spain, visiting all the early places associated with Catherine, and I got to pack my bags and head across the channel in Anne's footsteps to go first to Mechelen and then on to Paris and down to the Loire. So of course, we can talk about the usual places associated with Anne's earliest years, Blickling Hall and Hever, but in a way, they're so well known, particularly Hever. I think what's more interesting is to put your attention on those continental locations. And certainly when I think we were writing about those locations, very little emphasis was put on them and Anne's early years. Anne's story always seemed to sort of really, we were focusing on the time that she came back from France and that Henry fell in love with her, and we picked up the story from there. So we felt like, I'm not saying that we were carving new territory, that would be inaccurate to say that, but I think we were putting a spotlight on those early years in a different way by going and visiting the locations that she knew. And what was really enlightening to me, I remember very well being at the Château d'Amboise, which was one of the principal locations in the Loire. It was base of the French court, certainly for the first 3 or 4 years after Francis moved down from Paris. And I remember being there on the most beautiful, I think it was a September day, and the skies were blue and the swallows were sweeping around the building. They were nestling on the string course of the building, and I walked inside and it was all gleaming white marble, and the windows were open, and there was beautiful scented breeze just blowing delicately through the great hall. And I thought, my goodness, how different is this to a rainy English summer's day. You know, some of the dark, dank castles. Think Ludlow Castle, for example. You know, that Catherine was obviously sent to when she was first married. And it, just the contrast, and it just the whole vibe of the place, you know, just created this sense of carefree joie de vivre. And I could so imagine the young demoiselle, you know, flirting with gentlemen and being enchanted by the French court and just becoming part of its fabric. And so that, and also learning about the development of the Renaissance and the Renaissance architecture and how some of those palaces and castles were decorated, and how she came into contact with men of the Renaissance age, Clément Marot, and even Leonardo da Vinci was at Amboise at the same time that Anne was there, and he was putting on pageants and creating these amazing tableau, you know, the entertainments that were enjoyed by the court. And you could not escape how deeply influenced she would have been by that period of time. And that was enchanting and delighting.
I mean, as you said, I think the thing about Anne Boleyn's story is that this stint in Europe is sort of invariably just, she went to Europe, that's where her character was formed. But beyond that, people don't really explore, well, actually, what was she doing while she was there? Can you sort of walk us through the location specifically, and the order in which Anne was at them? And also, you know, what was she expected to do at those different locations?
So, as we know, Anne was a relatively young girl, a teenager, when she was sent abroad to serve, first of all, in the household of Margaret of Austria. Obviously, all royalty had various palaces, but the one we tend to focus on is Mechelen, which is the sort of the ducal palace in the centre of Mechelen. There's not much of that left, but there is some. So bravo. I think it's part of kind of municipal town buildings today. You can't actually go into the buildings, but at certain times you can go into the courtyard. So you can wander around the central courtyard and you can be right at the heart of that palace. I'd love to have gone inside, but as I say, very tricky to do so. But it was great to visit there, and actually to realise that just across the road was Margaret of York's old palace as well, which is now, I think, a theatre. There's only a tiny fragment of it left, but just some delightful, surprising things like that. So,
is that bit that remains of Mechelen what I think I've seen something that Susanna Lipscomb did, where there's like gorgeous sort of spiral staircases?
No, you're talking now about the Loire Valley, and you're talking about, I think, Blois and the Chateau de Blois. So we'll come to that in a moment. So I think pretty much everybody, you know, is fairly au fait with the, you know, the story of Thomas Boleyn getting Anne a placement at Mechelen, and she spends about a year there. She becomes fairly proficient in French, and she's just part of the, you know, the damoiselle d'honneur, the young girls who are both learning how to be ladies of the court, but are also providing companionship alongside the more mature married ladies of the court. But Margaret of Austria was a real patron of the arts, so she would have been exposed to, you know, music and the art of putting words to music and poetry and art. And Margaret of Austria had a fantastic collection of kind of Renaissance art. So it must have been, it's been quite dazzling having come from Hever to there. Just amazing, really. She then comes across, and I think this is the bit that people maybe miss out on. We think of Mechelen, and then we think of Anne in the Loire, perhaps in the principal palaces and the Chateau of the Loire. But in fact, she came first to Paris. Initially, she was moved there to be in the service of, course, Mary Tudor, Henry VIII's beautiful younger sister, who was marrying the aged Louis XII. And I think people miss Paris as a location because sadly there is so little left of medieval Paris. It was basically, this isn't over 10 years that I wrote the book, but it was basically swept away, you know, during what it would, it must have been the 1700s to create the Paris we see today. You know, but Paris, like London, was a walled medieval city with cramped, higgledy-piggledy streets, overhanging buildings. The Seine used to flood periodically and just wash the streets and clean the streets. You know, it was a world away from the Paris we know today, with the great open boulevards and the fantastic sort of buildings, I suppose, of the 17 and 1800s. And unfortunately, along with it, the great palaces have also been lost. But there were sort of two or three places that Anne would have, I am almost sure, there's no definite, because one of the issues, Adam, here is that Anne is a young girl. She's not an important member of the court. So we don't have any definitive Anne was here statements. We have to just basically work on the assumption that where the royal court was, Anne was probably not too far behind. But you had palaces like the Hotel Saint Paul and the Palais des Tournelles, the Hotel Vincennes, I think it is, which was just outside Paris to the east. You also had the Louvre, which is an ancient medieval palace, which was, I believe, falling out of fashion by the time Anne was there. But those two palaces that I mentioned, which were on the east side, north bank of the Seine, on the east side of the palace, away from the sort of the most cramped areas of medieval Paris. So basically, I think it was one of the King Charles, I can't remember which one, apologies, moved the royal centre from the kind of the Louvre and the old royal palais that's still on the Île de la Cité. You can go and visit the Chapel Royal on the Île de la Cité, which is just a magnificent Gothic building, which was part of medieval, kind of where the medieval French royal family would have based themselves. He moved them to the east of Paris, over to the Hotel Saint Paul and the Palais des Tournelles. That's completely gone. They're adjacent to where the Bastille, which was also a palace, by the way. And it was actually was almost certainly there when there was a meeting between the French and English courts. I think it was around the engagement of little Mary Tudor to the Dauphin. It was a huge celebration and feast held there. I mean, amazing descriptions of how the Bastille was decorated and the tournaments that were held. But it's all gone, sadly. So all that remains are street names, which hint at the fact that these palaces were there. So sadly, I think that's why people perhaps don't necessarily think of Paris as being one of the locations associated with Anne's early years. But I got quite a kick at actually out of going and standing in those spaces. But there is one place that is worthy of visiting, and that's the Hotel de Cluny, which was where Mary Tudor retreated to after the demise of Louis XII, where she was robed in her robes of white, which was the traditional sort of mourning garb of the Queen of France. And she was placed in seclusion for a period of time while everybody held their breath and waited to see if she was pregnant. And Anne, one assumes, would have been with Mary. And fortunately for us, that particular building is now the Museum of Medieval History. And so you can visit it. And you can see, apart from seeing the most amazing collection of medieval objects and art, you can go and visit the abbot's rooms still survive, which includes his bedchamber and the adjacent private chapel. Now, we know that Mary Tudor married Charles Brandon in that building. And so I think the supposition is it probably happened in those very private quarters. I think there were only 10 witnesses. So you can go and stand in the room, stroke rooms, the bedroom, the chapel, where that probably happened. So that's quite a thrill. And that's probably the highlight of visiting sort of Tudor Paris. And Francis stayed in Paris for a period of time, first of all, to find out that Mary wasn't pregnant. Also, I imagine, to just stabilize himself in Paris. But he eventually, not too long after, I can't remember the, no, we're talking, you know, months, moved down to the Loire. He'd grown up in the Loire. He'd grown up at the Château d'Amboise. So it was kind of his home base. And perhaps he felt most secure there. And that's where he travelled and he established himself at the Chateau d'Amboise for about 3 years, but moved between the principal royal chateau and two of the most magnificent alongside Amboise. The other one would be the Chateau Blois, which is also an incredible survivor. And that is where you see that wonderful staircase that you were talking about, Adam. It's both of them have, to varying degrees, rooms that we would be able to associate with the period. Sadly, the Chateau d'Amboise has about, I think it's about 20% left of the original buildings. A lot of them have been destroyed. But fortunately for us, the two ranges that survive, one is it's like the equivalent to the Great Hall, and then the privy lodgings for the King and Queen. So on the top floor, we would know that that's where Anne would have spent her time attending her mistress, Queen Claude. And then at Blois, you have the sort of Louis XII wing. And then adjacent to that, you've got a wing that was built by Francis himself. Now, that was probably completed after Anne left. So it's very difficult really to be able to say hand on heart that Anne knew or stayed in that particular range. But she almost certainly stayed in the Louis XII wing because that was there when she was attending on Claude. And for Claude was very, very fond of that palace. I think she'd grown up at Blois. But nevertheless, I would just say that if you want to see French Renaissance interiors or just Renaissance interiors at their finest, Blois and that wing, the Francis I wing, is one of the most spectacular places to visit. It really gives you a feel for how even Henry's palaces in England, although they wouldn't have had exactly the same style, you can see the kind of Seville tiles that we see, talked about, I think, in Anne Boleyn's apartments in Greenwich. She has some of these tiles. You just get to sort of see some of that amazing Renaissance interiors, and they are really staggeringly beautiful.
Thanks to the, as we discussed earlier, you've done extensive research looking at some of the more well-known of the palaces and castles associated with Anne Boleyn in England. So places like, obviously, Hampton Court Palace, Windsor Castle. And I know that you spent a lot of time looking at original floor plans of these places so that you could get a picture in your mind and then put into the book of actually how these spaces looked during Anne's lifetime and how they've changed over time. Can you discuss some of these specific spaces that, that whilst no longer look Tudor, but are still places that people can visit? So, what are some of the locations, for example, within Hampton Court or within Windsor Castle that people can go and check out that no longer feel Tudor, but actually were significant for Anne Boleyn?
Yeah, I mean, you have mentioned two of them that I think are most thrilling, and that is Windsor. And I'm passionate about trying to promote Windsor as a viable place to go to visit. If you do love Tudor history, you just need to know what you're looking at. As you said before, all the interiors were changed by the Georgians and the Victorians, and there were massive changes to the layout of the apartments and the spaces of the privy range at Windsor, such that it is unrecognisable unless you absolutely know what you're doing. Apart from the fact, the main change at Windsor is that there used to be two internal courtyards, but today it's one solid block, so everything is covered. So at some point, and I don't know, as I say, in the 1700s or 1800s, those courtyards were enclosed with roofs. Floors were inserted to create a ground floor and a first floor. For example, the Waterloo Chamber, which is one of the earliest chambers you walk into when you visit Windsor. You go up this grand processional staircase and you go into this Waterloo Chamber. That was actually an inner courtyard originally. And so you're basically standing in midair in the Tudor period as you're standing in the Waterloo Chamber. And over to your right would have been a gallery connecting one side, the Queen's Great Watching Chamber with the King's Great Watching Chamber, if memory serves correctly. And on your left side, you would have seen windows that would have looked into the King's Presence Chamber. And the King's Presence Chamber, as you quite rightly point out, was where, we know because it's recorded, it's where Anne Boleyn was made Marquess of Pembroke. But today it's the Garter Throne Room. So again, you see, you can go and stand there and you would, you would just walk through it. You would just walk through it if you had no idea. And yet we're standing in a place that was so important to Anne's story. I often want to go in there and I want to sort of tap people on the shoulder and say, do you know what happened in here? Just walk through.
And, yeah, you should go in there with a megaphone and be like, just FYI, folks.
No, it's really sad, really, isn't it? But, you know, and then you can you follow the route round. And I mean, obviously, it's quite difficult to describe, but you basically follow the visitor route round. And it takes you through a series of bed chambers that get that get smaller and smaller and smaller. And of course, that would be the usual arrangement of chambers in any Tudor palace. You start with a larger chamber and they get progressively smaller as those chambers become more intimate, more secret.
It's called enfilade, isn't it? Is that the right word?
They are on Fallard now. Yeah, absolutely. And at the corner of where you finish with those bedchambers, there is a room, and it's the room in which you have that very portrait that I was talking about. It's the room where you've got the portrait of Princess Elizabeth as a sort of 13-year-old in that red dress. That room was basically the point at which the king and the queen's bed ranges joined, and that's where their joint bedchamber would have been. So if they wanted to sleep together without anybody knowing, that's where that would have happened. And beyond that, you go into the Queen's ballroom, which was part of Anne's bedchamber and then her privy chamber. And of course, there's just no sign of any of that. So, yes, I highly recommend getting a map and orientating yourself and maybe buying in the footsteps, because it's all the hard work's been done for you in there, to be able to visit Windsor with completely fresh eyes. Hampton Court, of course, we've got a bit of the original palace left, which is fantastic. You might be disappointed to know that the Great Hall was not actually, because there was a Great Hall at Hampton Court when Wolsey owned the palace. But I believe it was on the ground floor, and the whole thing was raised up to a more fashionable first floor level. And that work, as far as I can make out, and I do keep asking people in case I've been fed misinformation, because people, that's the thing, research changes, you know. I mean, just look at Hever. We wrote about Hever in 2012. And since then, obviously, Dr. Owen Emerson has done so much, and the team at Hever have done so much work to understand more about the layout of the building as it would have been in the 16th century. And although I talked to people at Hever, I talked to the team there back in 2013, we know so much more. So actually, you know, things move all the time. People find out new things. So going, this is why I constantly going back and saying, it's still, you know, what we understand to be true. But the Great Hall probably wasn't completed until after Anne's last visit to Hampton Court. So whether she actually saw it completed, I doubt it.
So a question on that then, those H&As, do they represent Anne Boleyn?
I think they do. I mean, I think it was being put together while she was still queen.
Okay.
But they didn't visit, because, as you know, the court moved all the time. And I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, and I may fail in remembering the exact dates of their last visit. But it was being constructed, but they didn't necessarily even visit every year. And there was a period of time when Anne was last there, and then Henry returned again, actually, with Jane Seymour, some like 2 years later. So it's quite, you know, I can see absolutely that it would have been decorated for Anne, anticipating that she was going to come back someday. But of course, she never made it. Other spaces, yes, absolutely. You need to know for sure when you visit Hampton Court that as you walk under Anne Boleyn's gateway into Clock Court, that the range of buildings in front of you was the old lodgings that was built by Wolsey for Princess Mary on the ground floor, the King on the second floor, the Queen on the top floor. You could only access certain parts of that building. There's been so many internal changes that the flow of the apartments have been completely lost. They've been stripped out. The only bit that really excited me was learning and realizing by studying the floor plans that the Cumberland Suite, which is on the first floor, and that's first floor for those of you who use UK lingo, because I've come to realize that those folks over in the US think of the first floor as
As
the
the
ground
ground,
floor. So it gets very confusing. But I'm talking about the UK first floor. That Cumberland Suite there lies on the footprint of Henry VIII's old privy chamber and bed chamber. And again, although some of the walls might have been used and we haven't got the exact footprint, you are in that space. And you know you're in that space because of two giveaway doorways that always get me ridiculously excited. One is in a small passageway that connects, kind of would have connected into from his privy chamber to his bed chamber. And at the head of the stair, the gentleman of the privy chamber would have received Henry's clothes for the day. They come up from Henry's wardrobe, which is on the ground floor. And today, Adam, rather glamorously, that room is given over to lockers. So if you want to store your backpack, you'd be directed into this locker room, which was once Henry VIII's private wardrobe at Hampton Court Palace.
There's a certain irony in that, isn't there? That the room where you can now lock your belongings was where the king's belongings were in one way or another.
Yeah, and as you're fed into that room, you have to pat. You have to. You see, you probably wouldn't notice if you weren't locked on. You wouldn't notice, but you have to go in through a doorway to your right into this locker room. But ahead of you, as you go through that first doorway, is a spiral staircase, and that's the spiral staircase that led directly up to the king's privy rooms. That's where his clothes would have been taken and accepted by the gentleman in the privy chamber. So again, my imagination runs wild. And then the final room there, this little corridor connects to what would have been Henry's bedchamber initially. He then went on to develop the Bain Tower, which had, I think, another secret bedroom. But anyway, and you see, if it's open, it's not always open, but if it is open, you will notice in one of the corners, a block top doorway, which has one of those typical Tudor arches. And that doorway once connected through to the Long Gallery, which would have been, oh my God, every time I talk about that last Long Gallery, my heart just skips a beat because it would have been so amazing to walk through that door into the Long Gallery. And it also connected to Wolsey's private suite. And so this idea that these two men, early on in Henry's reign, when he was using that bedroom, could, pass in and out and communicate totally in private, it really spoke to me of, the closeness between them and how they would have run the kingdom, really. I'm just popping to see the king, and we're going to chat about the day and some business and so on. And so those little details, I think, bring things to life.
Yeah, totally. There's also quite a large and I can't remember the word, but there is an aspect of the Chapel Royal at Hampton Court that you do not
Yes.
enjoy. Can you talk to us about what that specifically is?
If people can't see me rubbing my face and clasping my hands in the horror of it all, but yes, if you go into the Chapel Royal, what faces you is this huge dark oak reredo, which is the piece. It's like the carved oak panel that sits behind the high altar, and it extends from floor to ceiling. And what I learned through my research was that there used to be, of course, that was the east end of the chapel. So there was once a beautiful stained glass window behind the high altar. And that was because originally, when Wolsey built Hampton Court and he built that chapel, there were no buildings behind it. So light would have flooded in and just flooded that room, that chapel, with light. And no doubt it was covered in stained glass, heraldic, arms of kings and Wolsey and maybe the reigning queen. But of course, Hampton Court was developed, more buildings were built. They were built behind that, the other side of that window, so light could no longer get through. And I presume that's why the Georgians, when they did their, continued this building project and redevelopment of Hampton Court, they put in this reredo. But as you know, Adam, because I took you there, if you know where to go, you can sneak around the back of the chapel and you can still see the actual stone molding of the window. is still intact, so you still can stand there and get a sense of what that window would have once looked like.
Yeah, I was shocked when there was quite a few of us, wasn't there? It was me, you, and James Peacock, and I, and Emerson, and James sort of showed us this great survivor that's just hiding in plain sight, essentially.
I couldn't believe it when I first saw it. I was like, oh. And of course, I actually wrote a scene in the chapel. I wrote a couple of scenes in the Chapel Royal for my novel, but one is the marriage of Henry Fitzroy to Mary Howard. That happens in November 1533 in that chapel. And you could just imagine the two, the young bride and groom, just sort of illuminated standing in front of this magnificent window. And it's so dark. And I mean, I love the ceiling in the Chapel Royal, but I find it so oppressive. And that's why it's not meant to look like that.
Can you talk to us about a couple of the lesser known locations that are closely associated with Anne Boleyn that can be visited in England?
Yes, we could be here all day, but I still have to try and limit myself, and that's the problem. And an interesting this question there, what is lesser known? Because to me, I now know all of these places so well that I can think somewhere is really well known, but maybe somebody would go, I have no idea that they went there. So I always find it a bit challenging to pick out what really is a lesser known place. And then there's the question of what do people expect to see? You know, I don't want to be pointing people to, as I've said to you before, an empty field where you've got some bumps in the ground. That's not exactly a great visitor experience unless you're a total nerd like me. I was thinking about this. I mean, I've already mentioned one. I would say the Hotel de Cluny in Paris. I really would, if people are going to Paris for a nice romantic weekend, do put the Hotel de Cluny on your list, because at least it is there and it's a, you know, a reasonably intact building. And there's a lot to see, and you can go and stand, as I say, in the space where quite possibly that marriage, that controversial marriage between Mary and Charles Brandon, took place. I was thinking also, okay, where else would be not so well known, but interesting.
I suppose also like areas that not necessarily lesser known, but we don't necessarily. So, for example, there's the other big castles like Arundel or Warwick or Leeds Castle. Do any of those locations have any sort of significant tie with Anne Boleyn at all?
Others have better ties with Anne Boleyn, I would say, and the ones that spring to mind are ones that I've talked about quite a lot that come up on the 1535 progress, which is Berkeley Castle, Thornbury Castle. They are, you know, right on the west of the country, so quite a lot of people, particularly if they're coming to England for the first time, will remain quite London centric. But I totally encourage people to venture out, because there's such a smorgasbord of wonderful places to visit and different areas of the country to see. In the West Country, the Cotswolds, where you have these two great castles. One's a hotel now, of course, and many people will know that. Probably alongside Hever, I would say it's one of the most luxurious and popular places to stay if your purse can handle it. It's not cheap. But, you know, Barclays are wonderful.
Which is Thornbury Castle, right?
Thornbury Castle, that's right. But Berkeley's a wonderful place to visit. And there you've got the residential range, the footprint of the Great Hall and the residential range, just as it was when it was built, I think, in the 14th century. The interiors have been changed, but you can go and stand in the spaces that absolutely the Great Hall where Anne and Henry would have dined when they visited Berkeley, and a portion at least of the Privy Range that they visited. You know, another great place to visit is Winchester. That Winchester is just a great place to visit. It's so historic. That was also on the 1535 progress. And you've got the magnificent cathedral, where apart from the fact that Mary Tudor was married there, and there are probably some of the most amazing chantry chapels to see in the country, including the one of Stephen Gardiner, of course. It was where Henry had three reformist bishops consecrated, probably with a lot of influence from Anne. So they were no doubt in that building. And next door you have Wolvesley Castle, which was the archbishop, or the bishop's palace, I should say, which again was very often used. It was used for the where Mary the First stayed prior to her wedding. It was used for her celebrations after her wedding to Philip of Spain. And no doubt, although we don't know for certain, I've no doubt that that's where Henry and Anne would have stayed. That's in ruins, but there are substantial ruins to see. And they're not too far away. Also, kind of part of their visit to Winchester was Bishop's Waltham Palace. Again, this was a country seat of the Bishop of Winchester. And very often, when royalty were moving around the country, there were certain places they would stay. And one of them, as we know, would be abbeys, but also, bishops' lodgings like this. The bishop would cede their lodgings, it would be taken over by the royal party. So I've no doubt. And they also had country seats, like at Bishop Waltham, which was a significantly sized castle. And you can see a courtier's room there. Then you can also see the remains of the West Tower, which again was part of the bishop's privy lodgings. And I've no doubt that that was part of where the royal couple stayed. So many different places, honestly, just so many wonderful places to visit.
The Tower of London is obviously very closely associated with Anne Boleyn for a couple of major reasons, both her coronation and her execution. Now, sadly, much of the Tower of London that Anne would have recognised is lost to us. But so can you tell us a bit about the spaces that she occupied that are no longer there? And I suppose, again, to inspire people when they visit the tower to think about where they stood and sort of look at the spaces that just aren't there anymore.
Yes. So when you're talking about Anne Boleyn at the Tower, you're talking about the royal apartments, which, as you point out, are gone, completely gone.
Very frustrating.
The tower, like any castle, if you like, has the outer ward or outer bailey, outer courtyard, which is the bit that, most people spend time wandering around. And then you've got the keep and the ki then you had the Cold Harbour Gate, which separated the outer ward from the inner ward. The Cold Harbour Gate, again, there are kind of footings still remain to the left of the keep as you kind of enter into the tower. You're looking up at the white, the main keep. Directly adjacent, abutting the keep, was the remains of the Cold Harbour Gate. So that separated like the public part where everybody could be. And then the inner kind of royal complex of lodgings wasn't a particularly big area, but it consisted of either some courtiers' lodgings or service offices along one range. Then you had the Great Hall, and then perpendicular to that, running back from the Great Hall to the White Tower, were the royal lodgings. And interestingly, the one interesting fact about the royal lodgings at the Tower of London is that the king's side was smaller than the queen's side, which is really unusual. In most palaces, of course, the monarch, the reigning monarch, which was in most part, certainly up until Anne's life, was the king. That side, those range of apartments, there were usually more of them and they were usually bigger and slightly more splendid. But here at the Tower, we've got the queen's apartments are bigger than the king's, and that's sort of thought to have been, because of course Henry had them redeveloped and refurbished for Anne's coronation. He was trying to make a big deal out of this. He was trying to make everybody know how important she was and that she was rightful queen. So she had a whole constellation of apartments there, including, presence chamber, great dining chamber, bed chamber, all furnished in the height of Renaissance fashion, and sadly, all gone.
All gone. And the Great Hall as well. I mean, there was at one time this Great Hall at the Tower of London, and I believe, I could be wrong, but I believe it went sort of lengthways, sort of, so parallel to the Thames.
That's
What
right.
happened to that?
I think, like everything else, it just fell into decay. I'm trying to remember. So I think Edward and Mary, did Mary use the tower for her coronation? But by the Elizabethan period, it was already kind of being abandoned. Not surprisingly, Elizabeth must have had some pretty awful associations with the tower.
Yeah, wouldn't have been her favourite spot.
Yeah, and she probably really never wanted to see it again, which you wouldn't blame her. But it started to fall into disrepair quite early, and I think just nobody put money into it. And therefore, it just began to decay, and eventually, we just pulled down. But I would say that the Great Hall at the Tower is thought to be very similar. This is another reason to visit Winchester. I didn't plan this, but this is working out quite well. The Great Hall of the old Winchester Castle, which was really important place in medieval England, early medieval England, by the way. Winchester was the capital of the country before it moved to London. The Great Hall still survives there, and it was built about the same time as the Great Hall at the Tower of London. I think Henry III's, but I wouldn't put money on that. And so if you go there, you're said to, and stand in that Great Hall, you're said to have a good feel for what the Great Hall at the Tower would have been like.
One of the things that frustrates me quite a lot about the Tower of London is that spot. It's very sweet, but there's this, and quite melancholy, there's this spot just outside the Chapel of St. Peter at Vincula where there's a memorial which says, this is where Anne Boleyn and Catherine Howard, Jane Grey, etc. were executed. Now, I believe that is wholly inaccurate, and that the scaffold was actually erected somewhere else. Were you able to sort of find out exactly where Anne was executed, and what sort of route would have she have taken from where she was lodged to the scaffold?
Yeah, I mean it's one of those Victorian niceties that sort of they created a number of myths, didn't they, that have been propagated, and then we've got this beautiful, much more modern day memoriam to those executed, and it is beautiful and it is touching. I suppose it's just convenient though that it is out of the way, because the real scaffold was on is on kind of the parade ground to the north of the tower, so it's sandwiched between where the north side of the tower is. So that's the tower furthest away from the Thames and the building that houses the barracks where you've got the crown jewels today. So it was somewhere on there. That's where the scaffold would have been erected. But I suppose to put it there, it's a little bit inconvenient. It's much more out of the way, isn't it?
So roughly speaking, where people queue up for the crown jewels is probably where the scaffold would have been erected.
Yeah, somewhere there. And I think the other thing that people maybe don't realise so much, which lovely Alfred Hawkins from the Tower really pointed out when I was recording a podcast with him there a year or so ago, was that the area in front of the Chapel of St. Peter at Vincula was a graveyard. And now we hear of the bodies of the non-noblemen that were executed with Anne being buried in that graveyard, but apparently they're literally hundreds of people, if not, I don't know the figures, but Alfred was suggesting there are many, that was a significant graveyard because the tower was like a little mini citadel. It was home to people. It wasn't just a prison. People lived and worked there. The Chapel of St. Peter at Vincula was their parish church. So, there is a lot of bodies buried under there. But yes, going back to the execution site, it's just about where you're saying, just about where you queue up in front of the sort of sandwich between the north side of the tower and where you queue up to go into the barracks, or the Waterloo Barracks, I think they're called.
So the final question with that in mind then, there's this myth, and it's included within the Tudors, that Anne would have been able to see the execution of her brother and the other men who died alongside her from where she was housed. I'm assuming, based on what you're saying, that is complete myth and that she would not have been able to see the scaffold.
Yeah, one of the things we do actually in the Footsteps book is we bust three or four or five myths that constantly come up to do with the tower. And yes, this is one of them. Unless, and there is a debate about this, unless Anne was removed from her lodgings, marched through the inner ward, under the Cold Harbour Gate, across the outer ward, into the bell tower, and upstairs into the bell tower to sort of lean out of the window and see Tower Hill, then unless that happened, and I think it doesn't feel, why would they do that? I'm not sure there's any purpose in that, really. I don't think there was a, I don't think they were being sadistic. They just wanted rid of her. I don't think at that stage, I think they tortured her enough by putting her in there in the first place and, sentencing her to death. I don't see the reason why they would have done that. So they would have had, that's what would have had to have happened. But if she was in her royal apartments, unless she had X-ray vision to see through the White Tower and St. Peter and Vincula, no, she wouldn't have been able to see it.
There you go, folks. Myth officially bust.
I hope so. I
Amazing.
hope so. I'm sure somebody will have a different opinion.
So that scene of Natalie Dormer climbing up onto a trunk and sobbing from the Tudors, just one of the many things that the Tudors got wrong, is what you're saying.
It was one of those things that they say in TV. This scene has been created for dramatic purposes.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. That was such a fascinating exploration, and I think people are going to be really interested to hear what you've had to say and hopefully go off and check out some of these spaces for themselves or with us on tour at some point.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's what it's all about for me. Just encouraging people to, yes, enjoy London. Please do go and see all the main places. But just remember, there are so many amazing Tudor places to visit outside of London and even in France, you see. I always encourage people to head off to the Loire. It makes for a lovely holiday apart from anything else. But yeah. And then, of course, with us, yes, because we're going to be leading tours, aren't we, that are going to be London-centric, but also take people to places that they will have never been before.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much again for coming onto the podcast, and we'll speak soon.
We certainly will. Thank you, Adam.
And so that brings me to the end of this week's episode of the Tudor Chess Podcast. My thanks to Dr. Sarah Morris for coming onto the show and sharing her fascinating discoveries with us all. Tomorrow, the fourth in my Historian Unwrapped sessions lands on Patreon, this time with Dr. Joanne Paul. Thank you again for your support of the Tudor Chest, and speak soon.